Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, I'll talk with Sharon LaRue about this year's Take Back the Night vigil at the University of Louisville. First, last Sunday's windstorm broke hundreds of utility poles and downed over 8,000 wires. Afterward, more than 300,000 Louisville-area residents were without power. Louisville Gas and Electric predicted it would take up to 2 weeks to restore service to everyone. To accommodate those without power, the American Red Cross set up a shelter at Louisville Gardens. Gabe Bullard went there on Wednesday and prepared this.
We have served over 4,400 meals since Monday. Food is definitely what has been requested of us, and the Red Cross will continue working at the Louisville Gardens for as long as needed until everyone has power up and running.
You know, lights out and food running out. And I was talking to a friend last night, and they told me, you know, the garden's open, so I came over here, and here I am. You know, it's been difficult for not only for me, but for many people, because I've just talked to people in general, and everybody's just frustrated because I think this is the first time they've had to face such a challenge, you know. When lights go out, I mean, that causes a lot of problems in every area, you know. Hot water, you know, your food, you know, you can't see, you know. You know, it just makes it difficult.
Hey, this is my first day working here with this shelter, but apparently very well. We have a limited number of clients. Some few folks are coming in for hot meals and taking those and leaving, but other than that, it's very easy compared to the Gustav evacuation.
What particular you been doing here?
Not much. I've ate some more, and I've slept. Talking to my grandma.
So electricity and everything, you've been getting it here?
Oh, sure. I appreciate it, too. Better than being in that house without no lights and no food. So I had to throw all my food and stuff away, you know. I'm praising the Lord for being here or somewhere to come to.
Oh, it's really good, you know. Due to the circumstance with the blackout, you know, the Red Cross is doing a beautiful job. You know, they're taking good care of us. I would like to know, you know, how soon will it be back on? You know, if it wasn't for the Red Cross, I don't know what I'd do. Because, you know, my son had breathing problems, I had breathing problems, so I had to come. We would like to see FEMA or somebody come through here. FEMA or Armstrong or somebody should try to help us with this bill, since we didn't have no power, is that, you know, dislocated us and put us out of our own homes and things, you know. And as far as the food stamp thing, I can't get no help on that because I don't get no food stamps. And all my food's just gone down the drain.
Those were voices from the Red Cross shelter at Louisville Gardens. While several thousand meals were served at the shelter, the need for bedding was said to be minimal. Thank you. The annual Take Back the Night Vigil will be held this week at the University of Louisville. The free event is aimed at raising awareness of violence against women. I spoke with Sharon LaRue, U of L's Director of Prevention, Education, and Advocacy on campus and in the community, also known as PEACE, about this year's event. Sharon, this is the 20th anniversary of Take Back the Night, correct?
Yes, in Louisville Metro. It started in 1988 by a group of women, a small group of women from the NOW group. And so we're really excited that we're going to be able to honor some of those women at Take Back the Night this year.
Tell us, give us a little history lesson about this. What prompted it? How did it get started?
I believe it was actually started in the 70s in Europe, and it was really a time where women were saying that they were not going to be afraid to walk at night. There had been a series of rapes and murders, and they just decided that they were going to take back the night. And so it began in Louisville, like I said, in 1988. And so I think it's really an event that is commemorated around the world and something that we really want to be a part of here in Louisville.
So the 20th commemoration here in Louisville is coming up on Tuesday, the 23rd?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
What's going to be happening at that?
Well, traditionally, Take Back the Night has a rally where you have speakers and music and people that talk about the issue, bring public awareness to the issue. It also typically has a speak-out session, which is where victims or supporters of victims actually come and talk about maybe this is the first time they've ever publicly talked about what happened to them, and it's a real time to empower themselves and also to just say, I'm not going to be ashamed that I didn't do anything wrong to, you know, deserve this. So it's usually a time that it really sets people free from some of the kind of things that have kept them maybe silent in the past. And then there's usually a candlelight vigil and a march, and we'll be marching around campus. So those are the traditional things that we have every year.
And you will have a keynote speaker?
Yeah, our keynote speaker this year is Dr. Dorothy Edwards, and she is part of a statewide campaign called the Green Dot Kentucky Campaign. And this is really looking at violence prevention. So instead of just looking at how we're treating people that are victims of violence, this is really looking at how we can prevent violence. And the focus is really not on women or the people that have been victims, but really on empowering the people that are around there, the bystanders, to take action, to figure out how to keep violence from occurring or interrupt a negative situation.
You're going to have some events also leading up to the event?
Yes, we have the Pinwheel Project, and this is where we have people can come. Anyone from the community is welcome to come and place a pinwheel just in memory of someone that they've that has been a victim. And we have our Men of Peace. They are going out trying to get signatures from men in particular, getting them to see this as an issue that they care about. And so they'll be going and trying to get people to do signatures. Last year we had about 1,200, and every year they try to get more men involved.
You've had quite a large turnout for Take Back the Night over the years, haven't you?
Yeah, we traditionally have had about 150 to 200. It just depends on the weather and people, you know, really being able to come down. And we're looking for a good crowd this year since it is the 20th anniversary.
Well, what is the status of violence against women here in the Louisville area? Is it something that is it getting better, or is it something that's still a major concern?
I think it's a major concern. We're within national statistics. I don't think there's any more violence here in Louisville than in other major cities, but it's something that people may or may not be aware of the statistics on it. And we know that 1 in 4 women will be affected by violence. And we know that women are at high risk as they're younger, from 16 to 19. And so that's the reason that the university has taken such a proactive stance, is really looking at that age as these are some of the age of our students here. And so we really want to be doing things that are preventing or reducing their risk of violence, and really trying to stop that. So that's why the university has a program and why we're involved in this issue of Take Back the Night.
Where can people find more information about the event?
They can look on our website, on the University of Louisville website, and our PEACE is spelled P-E-A-C-C, and you can search on that. We also are on Facebook. A lot of people use that now, so we have a Faces of PEACE site on there. And I think that Leanne Yost is also going to be one of our musicians. She may have posted something on her website, too.
Okay, Sharon LaRue, Take Back the Night, coming up September 23rd at the University of Louisville. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
More information about Take Back the Night can be found at our website, WFPL.org. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the repeal of Prohibition, but nearly half of Kentucky is dry. In many areas where alcohol can be sold, so-called blue laws prohibit the sale of spirits on Sundays. Gabe Bullard has more.
Walk into a liquor store in the Commonwealth on Sunday afternoon, and you've already done something most Kentuckians can't. Walk into Old Town Liquors in Louisville on Sunday, and you'll likely find the owner, Gordon Jackson.
Cannot open before 1, and we have to close by 9.
Those are the only hours on Sunday when it's legal to sell packaged liquors in Louisville. Liquor by the drink is also available at many restaurants.
We initially closed at 6 on Sunday instead of 9, but we found that once we opened until 9, there was a lot of business in those last few hours.
Other packaged liquor stores have been doing well on Sundays, too. Around the country, states that have repealed their blue laws have seen benefits. The Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. estimates that in 2006, 12 states that had recently repealed their blue laws saw a $212 million impact from Sunday liquor sales. About $5 million of those dollars were spent in Kentucky. Here, cities can vote to allow Sunday sales in restaurants, in liquor stores, or both. And since Louisville approved package sales in 2005, Jackson says Old Town has seen business pick up.
Sunday being a big grocery day, a lot of people go out to the grocery store and, wine and food seem to go together fairly well. And so our wine sales on Sunday are strong.
But others would rather see only holy wine being passed on Sunday.
As a Christian, I believe that one day should be set apart to be sanctified and holy to God, and I choose to do that on a Sunday.
Randy Pace is pastor of the Family Worship Center in Shepherdsville. He doesn't drink at all, and when the Shepherdsville City Council voted on a measure to allow alcohol to be served in restaurants on Sundays, Pace spoke out against it. It eventually failed.
I hope that you don't make me seem like some kind of a religious fanatic, because I have beliefs that I stand up for, but that's the only issue that I can think of that we have had a visible presence in opposition to.
Most of the people who want restrictions on alcohol and blue laws today, I think, are doing out of a religious worldview.
Dr. Dave Bowman is a senior lecturer in the history department at the University of Kentucky. Bowman says blue laws have survived mainly because of religious beliefs and self-governance advocates. But since the 60s, blue laws, especially in the South, have been increasingly repealed.
An awful lot of Southern regional tradition is brought into question during the Civil Rights Movement, at the same time that the Southern economy is being brought more into the national mainstream.
Bowman says, however, that some temperance regulations will likely stay in place.
In smaller towns and rural communities where Orthodox Christianity, Methodism, some Presbyterians, the Churches of God, I think the desire to have blue laws will continue, and it will continue to be a source of political controversy.
Temperance groups will sometimes cite public health and other factors in their support of Sunday blue laws, but those arguments haven't been effective everywhere as the laws continue to be lifted in much of the country. Closer to Louisville, it's a different story. Nearly half of Kentucky remains completely dry, and blue laws have been lifted almost exclusively in the central and northern parts of the state. Across the river, Indiana is one of 15 states that bans all Sunday package alcohol sales. Supporters of Sunday sales in Indiana and Kentucky are pushing for the repeal of blue laws, but retailers like Gordon Jackson at Louisville's Old Town Liquors don't want a repeal of all alcohol restrictions, like the one here that bans everything but beer from grocery stores.
One of the main things that concerns us is the sale of alcohol to minors and the sale of alcohol to people that are operating cars inebriated. And I think that that's a judgment call that requires a certain amount of maturity, and I'm not sure that their staff has that maturity.
And that's something he has in common with blue law advocates. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
You can listen and learn more about our local features at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Robin Fisher talks with author Daniel Blake Smith. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Elizabeth Kramer talks with author Ed McClanahan. First, the Virginia settlement of Jamestown is considered to be the only English colony to survive the early days of what would become the United States. Infighting, raids by local Native American tribes, poor agriculture skills, starvation. If it wasn't for a last-ditch rescue effort by the Virginia Company, Jamestown wouldn't have made it. Daniel Blake Smith, in his new book, The Shipwreck That Saved Jamestown, explores this rescue mission, the disasters that befell the rescuers, and how they eventually saved Jamestown. Robin Fisher talked with Smith about this chapter in our history.
I have to start sort of at the beginning. I had no idea how close we all came to being Spanish. So tell us a little bit about the status of the New World at this time in the 1600s when Jamestown sort of came to be.
Well, it is true. The Spanish Empire was far and away the most powerful the world had seen since Rome, and the English were very last minute and rather dismally failed, folks trying to get into the New World. They had seen since Columbus, and particularly the conquest of Mexico and Peru, and all the gold and silver mines that were established, and all the treasure fleets that were coming out of Mexico and so forth, that the Spanish had laid claim to something incredibly profitable that only drove up the envy of the English. But the fact was that they were nearly 100 years behind them. So the only thing they could do, quite frankly, and pretty feebly at this, was beginning in the late 1570s and 80s, they began being pirates and raiding these fleets coming out of Mexico and Peru and so forth, and the Caribbean in particular, including some of the people that are critical in this book, played a hand in this. George Summers and Christopher Newport did their share of raiding treasure fleets alongside Sir Francis Drake and other well-known pirates from the English swashbuckling English folks who were pretty effective there. And that basically represented England's effort. You throw in the episode of Roanoke in the 1580s that, of course, is renowned for its failure and the mystery of what happened to them. But the English were missing in action in large part because their own government was caught up in its own internal struggles and were worried about incurring the wrath of the Spanish, and even though they hated them because they were Catholic and this had become a Protestant nation with Queen Elizabeth and so forth, they kept a hands-off attitude until, quite frankly, some enterprising merchants and mariners and adventurers, and they used that word literally and figuratively then, decided to take some risks and see if they could settle the New World, and they did it at first with just kind of nonstop failure, to be honest about it.
Well, tell me, were the original colonists of Jamestown familiar of what happened to the settlement at Roanoke?
Oh, yes. They didn't know the exact answer. They assumed that that the Indians probably had decimated them, but like us today, they didn't have the smoking gun on it. They just knew this was a difficult place to lay claim to on a permanent basis. And they were appropriately wary, although they had all these other notions kicking around in their head that drove them forward that, you know, with present-day knowledge would seem silly to us today, but the idea that they could quickly find a Northwest Passage through North America and the Indian Ocean lay just maybe a few miles into the hinterland, or more predictably, they were thinking, we must duplicate what the Spanish did. Let's start digging in the forests of Jamestown looking for gold and silver. And they did that for quite some time before they dawned on them, okay, we're not going to have the treasure trove find that the Spanish did. But that was their primary impetus, was to find gold, become a profitable entity, and only kind of reluctantly did they realize, okay, the only way to make it, if we can do it at all, is to have a permanent settlement where we have to, God forbid, work with our hands and grow crops and do it the hard way. And of course, what ultimately happened to Virginia that none of them could have predicted was that they would end up becoming what they called a colony founded on smoke, that it would be the discovery of the profitability of growing tobacco there. This didn't occur to them until late 1610, so almost 10 years after they had first settled, that they might be able to make a go of it. And of course, they made an incredibly profitable go of it with tobacco. But you know, our story is focusing on those early years when they were, you know,
when they were
by all kinds of ambition and avarice, and then let's mimic the Spanish, and more, and at the same time, of course, lay claim with a Protestant colony to combat what they consider to be a pernicious and nothing but evil Catholic faith that the Spanish brought with them.
So, now, speaking of avarice, who is the Virginia Company?
Virginia Company was founded primarily by Thomas Smith, no relation to John Smith. I'd call him the Donald Trump of the 17th century. Never made a trip across the Atlantic, and yet was a great entrepreneur who saw that England's future lay in overseas ventures. And so he set up the East India Tea Company, East India Company, the Levant Company, the Muscovy Chuck Company that traded with Russia, and ultimately the Virginia Company, by bringing together entrepreneurs and a corporate-like structure, which is what the Virginia Company was. It was kind of an initial version of a corporation, in that it used spreading of risk among a lot of investors to raise enough capital, and you know, and so that if they failed, no one person would be sunk, and that did help raise the money to outfit the ships and pay for passengers and crew and livestock and provisions, marine insurance, all the rest. But it also showcases that this was an entrepreneurial activity rather than a state-sponsored venture, which was the case in Spain. And that meant that they were governed by the profit motive more than perhaps would have been helpful. Think in hindsight, the Spanish did it a more effective way because they had the state behind it, and for that matter, they had the church behind it, which made it much more. The public got behind the venture in the Spanish experience in ways that it didn't at first. In fact, not at all in the early days of Jamestown. It was only for this story of the resupply effort that we tell in 1609, the Odyssey of the Sea Venture and the ships that went with it. That's when you find, for the first time, that Thomas Smith and others realizing we can't just have a shareholder's mentality. We've got to get the pulpits and the church and the public behind this as much as possible, because we are about to lose this fledgling colony in Jamestown. It's about to die off and be an even worse disaster than Roanoke was.
Well, I have to say, I'm a little surprised, looking at it from the profit standpoint, that they actually did bother to send the rescue ships. I mean, they had to hold a lottery to get people behind it enough to give them money. I'm surprised they didn't just write it off as we would today.
Well, there were plenty of people, Robin, who thought that might not be a bad idea, or at the very least predicted that would happen. Maybe they didn't want it to happen, but that would happen, especially those in Jamestown who, writing letters back and forth. Of course, these would go on ships that would take 2 months plus to get there. But they worried and pleaded desperately with officials in London, don't give up on us. We just need a year's more supply of food, and this will work. There is plentiful game and fish and flora and fauna here. We can make a go of it. But and I really do put a lot of the credit, if that's what you want to call it, on Thomas Smith, who just refused to give up. Now, I suspect that this thing had not worked out with, and at first, of course, it didn't, but if it had not worked out with the resupply effort in 1609, they might have given it up. But it was the largest, most audacious expedition ever mounted by the English up until that point in its history. The irony is that at first it completely failed, in the sense that everyone believed that they had lost all these great leaders on board the ship, and the ship itself had been lost at sea. But in fact, they reappeared 10 months later in what I like to think of as one of the greatest rescue stories in American history.
Well, actually, describe the Sea Venture for us and its mission, because our listeners won't know, and they won't understand then how the Sea Venture became Patience and Deliverance.
Well, the Sea Venture was a brand-new 300-foot ship, which sounds large, but when you think about 150 people and livestock and provisions and so forth on board, it was cheek-to-jowl kind of living, believe me. And the effort included, well, that was the flagship that had 8 other ships as part of the fleet, heading out in June of 1609 from Plymouth, trying to make the roughly 8-week trip across the Atlantic in the middle of summer, which is actually kind of dangerous because the heat pouring down on people in the sun in the middle of the summer was really tough on people for, you don't think about this, but sunburn and all the rest. It was really dangerous, but they thought a quick way to get across. They felt like they just had to do it. Time was running out. And they had 8 other ships with them. They made it 2/3 of the way across with great speed. They had found a wonderful angle to get across that so far had proven very effective, sailing in calm weather and doing fine. And then about 600 miles from, or about a week to 10 days from arriving in Virginia in late July, they ran into a horrendous hurricane and found themselves separated from the other. Since they were the lead ship, they caught the brunt of the storm, and the other 8 ships managed to struggle and skirt around it. And in fact, they ended up hobbling into Jamestown a week or two later, with minus all their leaders, who were all on board this one ship, the Sea Venture, which, by the way, we asked, why would they all be on board one ship? This is Thomas Gates, the upcoming governor of Virginia. This included Governor George Summers, the admiral, and Christopher Newport, the very experienced mariner who was a ship captain. Also, by the way, included John Rolfe, who would later marry Pocahontas, but was married to another woman at the time. And, in fact, they had a baby in Bermuda while they were marooned there, and they named their baby Bermuda. His wife died shortly after that, which therefore made him free to marry Pocahontas. That's another side story that goes on in the larger adventure that this was. But they had this caught in a hurricane. Not only were they, as one of them put it, being besieged by water from above, but there was a mighty leak down below in the ship, and the ship was filling up with water from below. And they divided the entire crew and passengers into teams to bail water 24/7, and they managed to keep from sinking for 4 full days with that Herculean effort of just bailing water. But it was, as you can imagine, a losing enterprise with the hurricane bombarding them with water from above and the leak getting worse from below. And they finally, near the end of the 4th day, decided that some of the people broke into the remaining liquor supply and toasted themselves to their death, upcoming death. And amazingly, though, they didn't find the watery grave that they thought they would, because just about that time, George Summers, up on the poop deck, as they called it, spied land and managed to steer the ship onto this coral reef, stuck between two coral reefs, and which was amazing itself, because they had landed, lo and behold, about a half a mile off the shore of Bermuda, which was then called the Isle of Devils, and in fact was seen as one of the most diabolical places you could possibly ever find yourself. I guess you'd say it was a 17th century version of the Bermuda Triangle, except that stands for today being lost somewhere. But here it was a very specific place that sparked terror in the hearts of mariners and ship captains who had managed to sail by it. And the reason that it shocked them was, and it struck terror in their hearts, was that the hulls of their ships would be torn up going through there. They heard these wild screams of animals and howling winds, and they just thought, oh, my God, this is such a horrible place. So bad was it, Robin, that even though you say, well, the good news was they spied land, they weren't going to all sink and drown to death, but Summers and Christopher Newport, being experienced mariners, did know that this was Bermuda, and they thought this was such a horrible place and a frightful place that they actually thought about not going ashore and just saying, let's just give it up. However, they decided to take the devil over the deep blue sea, and they managed to help people. They had the little pinnaces and small boats, rowboats behind, and worked over about a 12-hour period and got everybody offloaded and onto the island safe. They even saved, even the shipboard dog survived, so they lost no one, which is amazing.
And then the funny thing is, when it came time to leave, no one wanted to leave because they were in Bermuda.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you know, they had done the math on this. They thought, okay, we're going to Virginia, which is a death trap. It's a hellhole. And of course, one of the ironies that they could have guessed but didn't know, but they found out when they got there, was this was while they were luxuriating in the ease and plenitude and abundance of this tropical paradise, Virginia was undergoing the famous starving time, where people were reduced to cannibalism and digging up cadavers. And so this was a world where they left poverty and plague in London and knew they were headed toward a place where maybe if they worked hard, they'd be doing the king's mission and help this desperately dying Jamestown to survive. And yet here they were on this island that at first they were fearful of, and then quickly discovered that, wait, they didn't call it this, but it was coral reefs that were ripping up the hulls, not evil spirits, that the howling birds were these cow animals that had, because it was an uninhabited island, they had no natural predators, and so they have these, they screamed kind of like, they said like screaming women is the way they described the sounds they made in the mating season, and they would fly right up and land on your shoulder, which meant that they were easy to be taken in and for food supply. There were wild hogs running everywhere on the island. You say, how did that happen? Well, another fateful shipwreck by the Spanish years before had left no one alive, but some hogs had managed to swim to shore and then populated themselves over the years with no natural predators. So they had plenitude of food, meat supply from the hogs. And so these guys were thinking, okay, look, we're living pretty large here. Let's stay here. And if it weren't for Thomas Gates and George Summers, especially Thomas Gates, who was there, he kept his eye on the prize, which I've got to get to Virginia. I'm supposed to be the governor there if we can ever get to Virginia. That's our mission. That's why this whole enterprise got launched. That's God's will that they believed they were doing was to save Virginia for England and God and Protestant and the Protestant faith, save Jamestown for Protestant England, that that he quickly put everybody to work building boats. They managed to salvage a few timbers off the Sea Venture, but it was otherwise completely destroyed and of no use. They had a wonderfully abundant supply of cedar, which makes great boat-building material on Bermuda. And so over 10 months of being marooned there, despite several mutinies, people who didn't like what was going on, they did have two boats built, one called the Patience. I love the names of these, the Patience, and the other was the Deliverance. And in May of 1610, some 10 months after they had first hit land there, they sailed on, except for three people who had been part of the mutiny. It felt like, gee, when we get to Virginia, they're going to, things are going to go bad for us. So they stayed on the island of Bermuda. Later became the subject of a Washington Irving story called the Three Kings of Bermuda. But all the others went to Jamestown, where they arrived just at the end of this horrific starving time, as the governor of then governor George Percy said, you will read on our people's faces a lecture of misery, and it was. But they helped then save it with the provisions that they brought, and one of the largest legacies that people actually know but don't know about this whole story was that it was the inspiration, this magical story about the amazing rescue that the Sea Venture accomplished, even if it took 10 months in Bermuda to do it, became the inspiration for Shakespeare's last play, The Tempest.
Well, what surprised you the most in researching this book?
I think the thing I learned the most was that, first of all, there are great and relatively unknown stories out there about the contingency and uncertainties in history, and I think we tend not to appreciate how you know, it's not just well-known forces and prominent people that shape events, and you know, we tend to look backward from the 20th century or even looking backward from the 18th century when we know Virginia was this powerful plantation society, and you know, so we just look for the building blocks of that, and so we talk about racial slavery and tobacco and all the rest. We tend to forget, how did they view it? What drove these people, and how did the accidental things in history play a powerful shaping role that in some ways are more pivotal than knowing about what white Englishmen thought of African slaves or the upcoming encounter they would have with Indians, all of which is, of course, very important. But I think it was a lesson in courage, will, luck, the accident of history, piety in some cases. There was a lot of faith involved in this. A lot of people who, of course, weren't interested in religion. It was an interesting mix of adventure, pluck and luck, and at the same time, people who just wouldn't give up. So it's a surprising and I think humble mix of ordinary human traits raised to a level of in an extraordinary situation, raised to the level of high drama, and I think a terrific adventure story.
Well, Dan, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with historian Daniel Blake Smith about his new book, The Shipwreck That Saved Jamestown. Smith will be delivering a public lecture at the Filson Historical Society Thursday evening at 6. Visit our website for more information, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer talks with writer Ed McClanahan. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Kentucky writer Ed McClanahan is known for his true and fictional stories about colorful characters. His new book, Oh, the Clear Moment, delivers more of them. Elizabeth Kramer sat down with McClanahan and asked him more about his latest book and how he developed some of his fictional characters.
How did you come about putting this book together?
This book has a very funny history. I had been working on a novel for years, what I called a left-handed latter-day sequel to The Natural Man. It is a novel about my character, Harry Estep, who in fact is me. Anyway, that was my novel, and I was working along. And for whatever reason, I just sort of ran into a blank wall on it. I thought, well, I've got these other stories that had been published, but largely in pretty obscure places here and there. And I was thinking, you know, there's some pretty good writing in those stories, and I like them. And then there was also a story that I had been thinking about since 1991, my 40th high school graduation class reunion. So I thought, well, I'll write this story, Doug Loves Ellie, and instead of taking a couple of months, it took 3 years, and instead of being 10 or 12 pages, it was 60 pages long and became quite a meditation on my personal history and so forth.
How has that motivated you or fed into you writing your novel?
I have once again started thinking about going back to the novel as soon as I get done pimping my book.
You're definitely known for stories from your life. And how does that feed into fiction? How do you go back and forth between the two?
In a way, I don't go back and forth because every word of fiction that I've ever written is peeled right off of my own personal history. Even The Congress of Wonders, 3 long stories, and one of those stories is about a man with 2 noses who sets a bomb for another guy. Well, I tell people that, and they think, well, you made all that up, of course. But I knew a guy with two noses, and he did, in fact, set a bomb for another guy. This happened in my little hometown up in Brooksville.
You say even your fiction is based on real people, and a lot of your stories involve people who are quite famous. How do you deal with the repercussions after you publish a story?
What I say often in response to questions about that is that I like for my work to be redemptive in its nature. I'm very leery of saying writing anything that's truly unkind to the characters. If I'm going to be rough on a character, it's going to be somebody I've basically made up.
What is the value in writing redemptive characters?
It's like any other kind of salvation, I guess. You know, it feels good. I do believe if I can redeem a fictional character, that has a redemptive quality for me, too. It makes me feel better. That's all. I don't feel like such a heel.
And what about having characters like that for other people to read? Do you think that's important in today's society? And is it any more important today than it would have been 20, 40 years ago?
I do think it's important. You know, I kind of discovered this impulse in myself when I was writing The Natural Man.
When was the last time you did a tour like this?
When Congress of Wonders was published 12 years ago. Yeah, I did a little book tour.
And you enjoy reading in
front of them? Oh, I love doing readings, yeah. I really write for the readings. It's like a chance to sing a song, and I can't sing. So. But actually, I have a story in this book that includes the lyrics to three songs that I wrote, the three songs that I ever wrote. And I sing all three of them, although I can't sing a lick. As my dear friend Paul Krasner says, no, but you can lick a singer.
Well, hey, you know, whatever way it works.
Whatever works for But no, I love to do readings. I really do. And it's more satisfying by far than publishing something for me.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Writer Ed McClanahan is now on a nationwide tour of readings from his new book, Oh, the Clear Moment. After 16 years, the Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival in Moorhead, Kentucky is still going strong. The event is considered the largest bluegrass festival in the world and is taking place this weekend. Nicole Back of Kentucky Public Radio stopped by the mountain to see how things are going.
Diane Stevens has for 15 years been working the gate for the Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival. She says the economic slowdown hasn't stopped cars from rolling in this year.
The gas prices really hurt us, and a lot of people couldn't come because of that, but a lot had already booked to be here and everything, so we've got a good crowd up here, more than last year, so we're happy.
Some of those who regularly attend the Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival attribute last year's decline in attendance to new ownership. Cruise International now owns the Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival. The company is based in Auburn, Indiana. Former owner and Moorhead resident Marty Stevens now manages the festival. He says not much has changed. He is proud of Poppy Mountain and says area residents are blessed to have such an attraction.
They got fun right here in their backyard. They could all be coming up and bringing their tents and motorhomes or just driving in for a day, going to ride your horse or ride a four-wheeler or hear the music or fish in the ponds or dance or whatever we want to do and come right here for a whole lot less money.
The same man who was selling t-shirts at the festival 15 years ago is selling them today. Russell Klim has a home in Virginia but is on the road 42 weeks a year. He spends that time at festivals selling t-shirts that he has designed. He says he's always impressed by the lineup of musicians at Poppy Mountain.
Poppy Mountain is large enough that the crowd can reach critical mass when there's a certain time when entertainers interact with the crowd and there's a feedback that goes both ways. The crowd gets excited about the act and the act feels that excitement and raises the level of their performance even more.
With most festivals, Clem says there is a spiritual aspect, and there is definitely something spiritual going on at Poppy Mountain. Over 100 bands play each year on Poppy Mountain stage, but the stage is not the only place where music happens. That's Leon Queen from Gallipolis, Ohio, Gene Gollihue from Ashland, Kentucky, and Beverly Beers from Raleigh, Illinois.
Nice job, boy!
Yeah, you done good.
That's the first time any of us been around here together.
We don't even know each other.
Hey, that's what it's all about. That's bluegrass.
Although bluegrass music is the main attraction at Poppy Mountain, some people have other reasons for coming back each year. Roy Carr lives in Dayton, Ohio. This year marks his 10th for attending the festival. Not only is he a part of this year's Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival, he has been staying on the mountain all summer.
Well, tell you the truth, it's so close to heaven to me. And the friends, all of them, you can't beat the friends. It's around here on Poppy Mountain.
Carr has a plaque that was given to him by the Poppy Mountain staff for being the oldest person on the mountain. He's 83. He's also Poppy Mountain's Grand Marshal. Carr has been staying in Diane Stevens' camper. Her friends from Indiana are her neighbors at this year's Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival. They helped her decorate her camper for the most decorative campsite contest. She has a feeling she could win this year.
I got the hay and put it there, and they just got the mums and the birdhouse and the leaves and pumpkins, and all the pumpkins are real, but they're dried out with paint on them. So we can have them fixed from year to year. And I've had those since my daughter Amy was a baby.
Her daughter is now going to graduate school at Spalding University in Louisville. Clem says of all the festivals he has been to, none compare to Poppy Mountain.
Poppy Mountain is the biggest party in Kentucky. And it could even be the biggest party on the East Coast. There are a lot of people here, and is the first rule of Poppy Mountain has always been, since the inception of its festival, that everybody must have fun. And so the people that come here do have fun.
Carr says that couldn't be more true.
If you're not happy up here, well, you're not happy nowhere.
The main headline act for this year's Poppy Mountain Bluegrass Festival is, as always, Dr. Ralph Stanley. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Nicole Back.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.